And once again, back in Luke chapter 14, some of us have probably watched those programs on TV that revolve around Victorian manners in wealthy English households. When the family sits down around the table to a meal, they all recognize certain customs and manners and protocols, and woe to those who violate those traditions. Custom and tradition ruled what a person could and could not do and say around the table. Custom also dictated who could and who could not appear at that table at that meal. Well, custom, protocol, and tradition at a dinner table began long before the Victorian era in England. In the passage we're looking at today, in fact, we find Jesus sharing a meal with a group of people. In fact, they are Pharisees and lawyers, and they have their own set of traditions and protocols and customs that they recognize. But Jesus came in and he essentially overthrows or upsets the apple cart because he explains the way that they ought to be behaving and the way that they ought to be believing. Jesus calls for profound changes in our lives. If we follow him, we cannot continue to operate in the customary or traditional ways of the world. Following Jesus will have a profound impact on our priorities and on our relationships with others. We find in this passage three main events. First of all, Jesus heals a diseased man. And second, he talks about where we should sit at a banquet. And then thirdly, he talks about the kind of people we should invite to our next dinner party. Interestingly, all of these have something to do with eating. He's sitting down at a meal with some Pharisees and lawyers, and so he talks about the customs and traditions that they all recognize as they ate. Well, in each of these little situations, we find an underlying principle, in fact, a very practical principle that we should apply in our lives. So let's notice three practical suggestions that could profoundly change our lives if we implement them personally. First of all, in verses 1 through 6, we find the principle, prioritize your obligations. To prioritize your obligations. This all happened, as we find here, on the Sabbath day. Now the Jews, and Jesus was a Jew, they all recognized certain Sabbath day regulations. According to the Old Testament, you were not supposed to work on the Sabbath day. And the Pharisees had moved or really changed that tradition so that there were whole numbers of things that they were not allowed to do on the Sabbath day. The chief Pharisee had invited Jesus to come over to his house on the Sabbath day, probably after their Sabbath day service at the synagogue. This would have been a common thing. Jesus was a traveling teacher. He would come and probably speak at the synagogue, and then the chief Pharisee or the chief priest of that place, the leading religious figure of that place, would invite the traveling speaker over to his house for a meal. But it seems as if a little bit more is going on than simply sharing a meal together. In fact, it doesn't seem as if this invitation to meet were entirely on the up and up, certainly not due to simple kindness and generosity of the chief Pharisee here, because his intent apparently was to find something to criticize or something to fault Jesus about. We find that in the end of verse 1. It says, they watched him. Now, what's so significant about that, to watch somebody? Well, the sense seems to be they're watching with evil intent. They're lying in wait because they hoped that they could find something bad or something faulty about him. One of the writers said that they watched lurkingly. They're trying to trap him in his words, trying to catch him doing something wrong. It's the same kind of thing that we find in Luke chapter 11, 54, where it says, lying in wait for him and seeking to catch him in something that he might say, that they might have something to accuse him about. So they invited Jesus over to their house, or to this guy's house, sit him down at a meal, but they're watching him closely to see if he's going to say anything. It's sort of like today, the Democratic candidates or the Republican candidates or some, you know, candidate for office. People are just listening very closely to hear them if they'll say something that they can attack them over. Well, it's the same kind of thing here. They're hoping that Jesus is going to do something that they can attack him about. Notice verse 2, there was a certain man before him which had the dropsy. Today, dropsy is called edema, I'm told. It's a medical condition where excess fluid builds up in the body, causing swelling and inflammation. It's often a symptom of other diseases like heart disease or kidney disease. Now, why would a person with a serious health condition show up at this dinner party? It seems he's a little bit out of place. Now, he could have been there just because he had heard that Jesus was there. Jesus was known as a healer. He had a disease, so maybe he just showed up, perhaps, in the interest of being healed. Also, it was common in those days for poor people and needy people to show up at a luncheon just to get maybe some leftovers at the end. So the Jews were charitable people, and often they would do charity and give their leftovers to people who had needs. So maybe he was there just to get a little, you know, a chicken bone or something like that at the end of the meal. Or it may have been that the Pharisees brought him in just to see what Jesus would do with the guy. In other words, he was a plant. He was a setup to see if Jesus would heal on the Sabbath day. Now, Jesus had already healed on the Sabbath day, and maybe these Pharisees had heard about that, and if they're waiting and looking for him to do something that they could object to, perhaps they had brought him in for that very purpose. Here's a diseased man. Jesus has the opportunity to heal him. It's the Sabbath day. What is Jesus going to do? So maybe that's the deal here, and a little bit of a hint of that is found in verse 3. Jesus answering spake unto the lawyers and the Pharisees. Now, sometimes in the Gospels, when you have the Pharisees, they are friendly to Jesus. But in almost every case in the Gospels, kind of an interesting little detail, whenever you have the Pharisees and the scribes or the lawyers, they're almost always hostile to Jesus. So this is probably another one of those cases where the Pharisees and the scribes had gotten together to try to trip Jesus up in him doing something that they disagreed with. So that's probably, in my opinion, that's probably why he's there. Also note the word in verse 2, behold, there was a certain man. This word behold means, you know, note something that is a bit odd. This is a bit strange to have a guy like that at a dinner party. Typically, the Pharisees were very concerned about cleanliness. They were very concerned about ritual purity, and a diseased person would not be welcome at their lunch, at their dinner. This also would have been the elite of that society. The chief Pharisees, the lawyers, these are, you know, the elite of that society. And so to have a diseased guy there seems very much out of place. And so that's why I think, in my opinion, this was kind of an intended setup or a plant. The Jewish leaders were hoping that Jesus would do something that they could criticize, like healing on the Sabbath. And so what does Jesus do? Does he avoid this? Well, no, he doesn't. In verse 3, Jesus answered and said unto the Pharisees and the lawyers and the Pharisees, saying, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath day? So he answers their objection that they had not said yet, but they're speaking or they're thinking this. And so Jesus answers this objection that they are thinking about. Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath day? Now, we find in the book of Luke that Jesus had already done that on a couple of occasions. So Jesus doesn't have any qualms with healing on the Sabbath day. But the Jews would have seen this healing as an act of work. They didn't believe, or of course the Old Testament says you're not supposed to work on the Sabbath day. They would have seen almost anything that a person does on the Sabbath that was not necessary. They would have seen that as an act of work. So the Pharisees then in verse 4, Jesus asked this question, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? And they held their peace, and he took him and healed him and let him go. So they refused to answer. They held their peace. If they would have given an answer, they probably would have said, no, it's not legal, it's not lawful to heal on the Sabbath day. In fact, you may remember that I had said maybe a few weeks ago that the Pharisees had set up and recognized 39 categories of activities that they said were unlawful on the Sabbath day. Even lighting a fire, or in some cases even putting out a fire. If your house caught on fire, some of the Pharisees would say, you can't do anything about it, because you can't work on the Sabbath day. So that's how extreme they were, and virtually any kind of activity was outlawed by them on the Sabbath day. Well, the Old Testament simply says, don't work. It doesn't list 39 categories of activities that you can't do, but the Pharisees were pushing all this to an extreme. They wanted, you know, legalistically, here's exactly what you can and cannot do. And so Jesus really disagrees with their understanding of the Sabbath. So he explains himself then after he heals this man in verse 4. He explains himself in verse 5. And answered them, saying, which of you shall have an ass or an ox fallen into a pit and will not straightway pull him out on the Sabbath day? So by healing this man, Jesus demonstrates that it's good to do good on the Sabbath. Love and compassion for those in need is more important than keeping these man-made rules. Remember, the Pharisees are not implementing simply the Old Testament rules. There were rules about not working on the Sabbath day, but they had gone far beyond that. Old Testament Sabbath regulations allowed a farmer to take care of his animals on the Sabbath day. And so if one of them fell into a pit, probably here a well or a cistern, well, then he can rescue them, even if that happens on the Sabbath. He's not sinning by violating the Sabbath when he has to take care of a necessary thing like feeding or caring for his animals. All the Pharisees would have understood that. At this time, almost everybody would have had a cow or would have had a lamb or a goat or some sheep or something. Almost everybody had some hand in agriculture, and they all recognized that somebody in the family was taking care of those animals on the Sabbath day. So there was nothing that they could say in response to this because this logic was unassailable. In fact, they were eating a meal together on the Sabbath. So somebody had to prepare and to serve that food to these people. They didn't do it themselves. Somebody had to work on the Sabbath day to prepare and provide for them. So this, even the highly strict Pharisees recognized that there were exceptions to the rule on what you could and could not do on the Sabbath day. So if this were true of farm animals, if you can pull out your donkey or your ox out of the pit on the Sabbath day, well, then it makes sense that you could heal somebody on the Sabbath day as well. Notice what the response to that was, verse 6. They could not answer him again to these things. In verse 4, they would not answer. They held their peace. And here in verse 6, they could not answer because the logic of this argument was beyond dispute. Jesus' wisdom in this case is irrefutable. The Pharisees had a view of the Sabbath that focused on what you could not do or should not do on that day. They felt obligated not to work. Don't work on that day. Jesus had a view of the Sabbath that focused on what you can and should do on that day. He felt obligated to do good, to heal this man. You might say that they had conflicting obligations or competing obligations. There was an Old Testament obligation not to work on the Sabbath day, but Jesus felt an obligation to do good on the Sabbath day. Where should we put the emphasis on not working or ceasing our labor or doing good? They both are obligations. Jesus sensed the obligation to do good on the Sabbath. The Pharisees sensed the obligation not to work. Both of them have a biblical point, but which one is right? So, we all have conflicting or competing obligations from time to time. One set of obligations compels us in one direction, and another set of obligations pushes us in another direction. There are times when we know that we should do something, but we have something else that is a higher obligation or something that's more important, more valuable to us. And so we struggle with knowing what we ought to do. So how do we choose between those two options? Well, we have to prioritize. We have to choose which is more needful or necessary. It was better for Jesus to show compassion to this man than not to do so. Not working on the Sabbath day was important, but it was more important to do good, to heal this man and to alleviate his suffering. And so oftentimes when we have competing obligations, we see one obligation as competing against another. And so we need to determine between the two based on which is going to be better for the, you know, what's going to be more beneficial for the other person. The Pharisees had these rules, essentially man-made rules, that they insisted that everybody keep. Jesus came along and said, I'm not going to keep your man-made rules. There's something more important than keeping those rules, and it's being compassionate and showing love and concern for another person. So oftentimes when we have competing obligations, we should ask ourselves, which is going to be more beneficial for the other person? Which is going to be more compassionate? Which is going to alleviate suffering? I'm going to do the thing that is more beneficial for the most people. I'm not going to be stuck by man-made traditions and customs. I'm willing to violate a custom. I'm willing to, you know, not follow some custom or tradition if it means that I can be loving and compassionate and kind to somebody in need. So our value or our priority ought to be for people and not necessarily for customs, traditions, rules, whatever you want to call it, especially man-made customs and traditions. People are more important than that. However, having said that, when we talk about competing obligations, sometimes it's not really an obligation versus an obligation. Sometimes it's an obligation versus a desire. We know that we should do certain things, but we really don't feel like doing that, and so we desire to do something else. Now, this is all revolving around what is appropriate activity on the Sabbath day. Now today is Sunday. Today is not the Sabbath day. There are Christians who would call Sunday the Christian Sabbath, but that's, to me, that's not really biblically sustainable. Today is called in the Bible the Lord's Day. And so we're not under the Old Testament restrictions for the Sabbath day. We don't recognize the Sabbath day as they did in the Old Testament. Under the church system, under the New Testament system, we're not under those Old Testament Sabbath day regulations. However, this is the Lord's Day. So that gives us, I think, a whole new set of obligations. My feeling, my sense of obligation is that on the Lord's Day, I need to be in the Lord's house with the Lord's people. I believe the Lord's Day is set aside for fellowship, for worship, and instruction. And we ought to set aside that day as special to worship and to serve and to fellowship and to encourage other people. That ought to be our priority. That ought to be what we have determined to do, to dedicate ourselves to serving the Lord on the Lord's Day. And so let's say we have competing desires or competing obligations. We have obligations to be in the Lord's house with the Lord's people on the Lord's Day, but perhaps we'd rather do something else. So it's not really a competition between obligation and obligation. It's really a decision between obligation to serve the Lord, to be in His house with His people, and desire. I know that I ought to be in the Lord's house with the Lord's people at the services of the church, but I'd rather do, fill in the blank, I'd rather do something else. I'd rather be out at the lake fishing. I'd rather be out hunting. I'd rather be recreating. I'd rather be traveling. I'd rather be doing any number of things. Even though it's the Lord's Day, I ought to be dedicated to the Lord, serving the Lord with the Lord's people in the Lord's house on the Lord's Day. Yet, I don't really feel obligated by that. Well, I'm here to say that you should feel obligated by that. I certainly feel that obligation. It's the Lord's Day. The Lord's house is open. God's people ought to be meeting together in service and worship and fellowship and encouragement. And to say that I'm not going to do that because I don't feel obligated or I don't feel like doing it, well, I feel like you're violating the spirit and the obligations that we have on the Lord's Day. So we're not under the Sabbath day regulations, but it is the Lord's Day. It is His day. I feel like I ought to be dedicated to serving the Lord in the Lord's house on the Lord's Day with the Lord's people under the teaching of God's Word. And so I made the commitment long ago to dedicate myself to being in the services of the church on the Lord's Day. That's the least that I can do, I think, in serving the Lord. I'm not under those regulations from the Old Testament Sabbath, but I am obligated to serve the Lord on the Lord's Day, to set that day aside, and to participate in the services of the church on that day. And I would encourage you to see that obligation for yourself. Well, we have conflicting obligations from time to time, and our priority should be on doing what is good, what is most beneficial, and is what is necessary. We should put the priority on human well-being, and we should make sure that we are truly fulfilling our obligations and not simply our desires. Let's go on to verses 7 through 11, where the principle here is humble yourself and let God exalt you. Humble yourself and let God exalt you. So notice verse 7, he put forth a parable to those who were bidden when he marked how they chose out the chief rooms, saying unto them. So they're still sitting at the table. Remember, they would not answer him, so he just keeps on talking. And so he mentions about this idea of bidding somebody or inviting somebody to a wedding or to a feast or a banquet of some kind. He puts forth this teaching in the form of a parable. We need to understand a little bit about the background of the society here to understand what he's talking about and why this makes sense. Social status was very important in that culture. For us, I think, you know, here in the Northwoods of Wisconsin, social status is not all that important. We really don't think too much about who we might sit down to a meal with. We don't think about, you know, who's got more money or less money, or typically we think of each other as equals, no matter how much money or how much status somebody might have. We still think of ourselves as equals. But at this point, these ideas of prestige and honor and social status were very important. Where you sat at a meal and with whom you sat at this meal were major considerations. They reflected your social status. So you couldn't just waltz into a room and sit any old where you wanted to at a banquet. There were protocols for this. Sort of like if you went to a wedding. If you went to a wedding just as one of the guests, Would you sit at the, what they call the head table? Would you sit with the bride and groom? You're just a guest. Would you sit there with them? Probably not. If you did, some usher or some, you know, brother-in-law or groomsman would probably come along and say, hey, buddy, you know, this is reserved for the wedding party. Well, it's a similar kind of thing. These people were very concerned about that kind of thing. You didn't just breeze into a room and just sit wherever you wanted to at a banquet. There were protocols, and the most noble or the most honorable person would sit in the best spot. The best spot was usually at the right hand of the host. So if it was a wedding party, the host would have everything set up, and the most noble person, probably, you know, a chief priest like this, or a scribe, or a Pharisee, a religious leader, would be the most recognized person, the person with the highest social status. In our context, it would be maybe, you know, a congressman, or the mayor, or a senator, or a wealthy businessman, or somebody like that. We recognize somebody with potentially a higher social standing. Well, in that time, in that period, everybody knew who the high and mighty people were. Everybody had an idea or a sense of, you know, who had the social standing. So that place would be reserved for the most noble person. And if somebody did not deserve to sit there, they would be asked to leave. People would sometimes seek to sit in the best spots. It was typical and expected behavior that people would show off their high social standing by occupying or trying to occupy the most honored position at a gathering. So you think of what we sometimes call social climbers, somebody who wants to be known in a higher social status. He would maybe go and try to sit in one of these chief seats. And if he was allowed to sit there, that would be like a recognition that he has the right. He has the social standing to sit in that place. So sometimes people would try to occupy the highest chairs or the highest spots. In verse 7, it talks about choosing out the chief rooms, literally the first seats. We shouldn't get the sense of room in the sense of a, you know, room in a house, but a seat around the table or a seat at a banquet. So if you took that spot and someone of a higher social rank came in, you're sitting right by the host and some congressman comes in, some, you know, famous athlete or some high religious leader comes in, the host is obligated now to ask you to leave the best place to allow the more honorable person to sit there. And then what would happen is you are shamed by that. You are humiliated by that because you tried to sit in a place of high social standing and you had to go down, it says, to the low end of the scale, to the lower seats or the seats that were reserved for people of lower social status. Well, notice what Jesus says then about that in verse 10. When thou art bidden, go and sit down in the lowest room, the lowest seat, the last seat, literally, that when he that bade you, he who invited you, comes, he may say unto you, friend, go up higher. Then shalt thou have worship, or the word there is glory or honor, in the presence of them that sit at meat with thee, those who are sitting at this banquet. When the host invites you to a higher position, then the others in the banquet will notice you. If you sit at the lower end, then the host will see you and he'll say, you're of better social status than that. Move up higher. Move up to a higher place. And then others would see that the host is exalting you. So the principle then in verse 11, whosoever exalteth himself shall be abased, and he that humbleth himself shall be exalted. If you seek that highest space for yourself, you're going to go down lower. But if you seek the low space for yourself, you're going to be brought up. And so that idea of humility, if you exalt yourself, you'll be humbled. If you humble yourself, you'll be exalted. That is a very clear Christian principle and one that, you know, we find throughout the Bible. For example, there's almost a parallel account in Proverbs 25 where it says, do not exalt yourself in the presence of the king and do not stand in the place of the great. For it is better that he say to you, come up here, than that you should be put lower in the presence of the prince. Another similar verse, let another man praise you and not your own mouth, a stranger and not your own lips. Take a humble position, and if you're going to be exalted, if you're going to be moved up, let somebody else do that. Let somebody else exalt you. Let somebody else brag on you. Let somebody else tell of your exploits. You don't have to be doing that yourself. When I was a youth pastor years ago, we had a kind of a star athlete in our youth group, and he would never let an option or a possibility go by of telling you his latest exploits. He would tell you how many you know, track sessions he ran and how he caught the ball in the football game and how he did all these things. He was a good athlete and he did a lot of wonderful things and he would tell you about it. He would brag about himself. And there are a lot of people who, let's say they do achieve great things, and they will let you know what they achieved. Well, biblically speaking, we ought to be humble and meek. Meekness and humility are godly virtues. Instead of seeking the highest places of honor, we should choose the lowest places of service. And if we are exalted, it should be others who exalt us. It should be God who lifts us up, not ourselves. We don't seek status from the world. We wait humbly before God and allow Him to move us up if He wants to. It doesn't mean that we turn down opportunities for advancement, but we let others, we just do a good job, we try to be humble and try to serve others and let others exalt us instead of exalting ourselves. James 4:10 says, humble yourself in the sight of the Lord and He will lift you up. It's the same principle. Humble yourself, allow God and others to exalt you. Pride and arrogance and boasting are serious sins. In fact, Jesus often charged the Pharisees with doing that. Luke 11:43, woe unto you Pharisees, for you love the best seats at the synagogue and greetings in the marketplace. So again, he's talking to the chief Pharisees and the scribes and lawyers here, and that's what they love to do. They love that acclaim. They love that exaltation. And Jesus is saying here, don't seek that. There's a verse in the Old Testament, seekest thou great things for thyself? Seek them not. What we ought to be doing is being humble and serving others and, like Jesus, washing the disciples' feet. That's what we really ought to be focusing on. So let's not be like the self-serving, arrogant Pharisees. We don't need to be pushy and assertive in gaining the chief seats. Social status should not be important to us. God is not impressed with our social standing. God values a humble attitude. And so be humble and let God lift you up. And then the final little situation here we find in verses 12 through 14. He said also to those who bade him, those who invited him, when you make a dinner or a supper, call not thy friends or thy brethren, neither thy kinsmen nor thy rich neighbors, lest they also bid thee again and a recompense be made thee. But he says go on to invite the poor and the lame and people who can't recompense you. So keeping with this theme then of hosting a banquet or a meal, Jesus gives some advice to us regarding how to select those we invite to our next dinner party. Typically, we might invite those who would invite us back. And in this culture, it was especially important. They would be charitable, they would be generous to others with the expectation that they're going to do that to me. So if I invite you to a banquet, my expectation is that you're going to invite me to a banquet. If I advance you a little bit, you're going to try to advance me. It's all sort of like favors. You do me a favor, I'll do you a favor. And so nothing was exactly free in that culture. Come over for a lunch, come over for a dinner, but my expectation is you're going to invite me to come over to your place for a dinner. I'm going to maybe try to advance you. Maybe you'll try to advance me. It's the old, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. You do something for me and I'll do it for you. Well, Jesus mentions four different groups of people here that we could expect to reciprocate or pay us back. He talks about friends, brethren, relatives, and rich neighbors. These are the kind of people who would be the inner circle. These are the friends. These are the buddies. These are the people who can help you. And I don't think he's saying to ignore those who can help you, but the idea is that we're not interested in people just because they can advance us. I'm interested in you. I want to be your friend because I know you can help me. And what I'm really saying is, I'm interested in me. I'm interested in you because you can help me. And the only reason I am interested in you is because you can help me. So that's not the kind of attitude that we ought to have toward people. In hosting a banquet with these people, you're really, in fact, serving your own self-interests. They can reciprocate. They can return the favor. They can advance your social standing. Now, obviously, he's not saying there's something wrong with inviting your friends and family over to a banquet. That's fine. That's good. But again, if you're only doing that, only inviting people over because you want to get something from them, well, then that's not the kind of humility that Jesus is talking about. If our interest in people ultimately boils down to what can you do for me, then we are being like the Pharisees. So Jesus invites us here to invite people, other people, different kinds of people. Notice in verse 13, When thou makest a feast, call the poor, the maimed, the lame, and the blind. What do these people have in common? Well, they can't pay you back. They are poor. They are outcast. They are on the margins. They can't do anything for you. They can't pay you back in the form of having you over for a feast. And they can't pay you back in the sense of advancing your social status. These are people of very low social status. Even fellowshipping with them could lower your social status in the mind of some people. So Jesus is essentially saying, don't enjoy people, don't fellowship with people just because of what they can do for you. Instead, fellowship with people who can't even pay you back. The principle, don't be so self-centered that your interest in others is based only on what they can do for you. People are not merely tools to help advance yourself. We don't use people for our own benefit. And so Jesus advances a different narrative or a different way of living. He compels us to invite those who cannot pay us back. So we should care about those who typically don't get invited to dinner parties and to banquets. We need to remember the outcast, those who are typically excluded from the fellowship. We should extend generosity without the expectation of repayment. We don't recognize social standing or status. We treat everybody equally, including the outcast, the poor, and the marginalized. What's the reason? Well, what's the blessing? Verse 14, thou shalt be blessed. In other words, give without an expectation because God will bless you for that. That's the kind of God that we serve. The Bible says, be merciful just as your Father also is merciful. So this is the way that God operates. God blesses those people who are like him. This is an attribute of God, to be merciful and kind even to those who can't repay you. God is merciful and just to the unjust. God is just and merciful to the thankful and the unthankful. He says at the end of verse 14, he cannot recompense thee. These people can't pay you back. They'll never invite you over for a meal. The poor, the maimed, the blind, they don't have the resources to pay you back. And so you don't worry when you invite these people over. You don't wonder if they're going to invite you over to their place. And then at the end of verse 14, thou shalt be recompensed at the resurrection of the just. So God is going to pay you back eternally. This is the gold and silver and precious stone. This is the treasure laid up in heaven. When you do good to others who can't pay you back, God is going to pay you back. God is going to recognize this. In fact, it says in Proverbs 9:17, he who has pity on the poor lends to the Lord, and he will pay back what he has given. So lending without the expectation of getting back, or really, we would just call that giving. We would just call that being charitable or generous. We give to those in need without the expectation of getting it back. And that's a good way to live, not always holding it over a person's head. Well, I was nice to you, now you have to be nice to me. And if you're not nice to me, well, then I'm going to be angry. Well, that's a hard way to live. That's not a biblical way to live. Obviously, there are things that we have to have paid back. You know, we enter into a contract and people are obligated to pay us back, or we are obligated to pay our bills. But in other cases where we can just be generous and we can give somebody the money and not worry about a payment back. And so that's the kind of lifestyle we ought to have, and then trust God to pay us back. I'm going to give you $50, and even if you can't repay me, I'm going to trust that God is going to recognize that I was like him and charitable in this way, and he'll take care of me, and I, you know, don't worry about paying me back. Well, we find in this passage three specific and very practical principles. And if we would apply them in our lives, it might have a deep and profound impact. So he says, prioritize your obligations. Love and compassion for others is more important than keeping man-made rules. And we should make sure that we are fulfilling our obligations and not simply following our desires. And then he says, humble yourself and let others exalt you. Don't seek those chief seats. Don't seek those high places of honor. Humble yourself in the sight of the Lord, and he will lift you up. And then do good for others without an expectation of repayment. Be especially sensitive to the needs of the poor and the disabled. Trust God to repay you for your generosity. If these principles become customary in our lives, I think the changes would be profound. Let's close in prayer.